When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm James, and this is The Stage Right Side with James Whiteside, where we'll dive deep into the dark world of dance and come up on the bright side. Oh, that's terrible. Welcome to The Stage Right Side. I am your host, James Whiteside, and I am here with designer extraordinaire Jean-Marc Puissant. How'd I do on pronunciation?
You did perfect.
Okay,
perfect.
We did some coaching before we turned the record on, so we're good, we're good. So where are you right now?
So right now I am in London. I came here.
Oh, and you got an email. Oh my gosh, what is it? Is it a big opportunity?
How do I do that? I don't know if I can switch that off.
Well, it doesn't matter. Just doesn't have matter. To hope that you don't get so many emails that I just want to tear my hair out, my podcast hair.
So yeah, so I'm in London. I came back here just in time for the lockdown.
Uh-huh.
And I've been
from
here.
Where were you before? Were you like, I mean, we were all in California.
We were all in California for Of Love and Rage. And then it was my first holiday in 2 years. So I had planned, to go to Mexico City for 2 weeks. And then I came back here. Mm-hmm. So the holiday wasn't really a holiday. I was already a little bit concerned with the situation with COVID-19, and I came back 2 days early. And while I was there, people were not concerned with it. There was no cases in Mexico at the time, but I had all my friends from London and New York, you know, speaking to me and saying it's crazy. So it wasn't a holiday.
Yeah, so I'm sorry that you wasted your holiday on that.
Well, I still had some great, you know, tacos and tequila. So
good. Yeah. Okay, so I want to know a little bit about your origin story. You were a dancer as well, and I just want to hear about your training and how you sort of transitioned into this prolific designer.
Mm-hmm. So I grew up in France in a tiny village in the Alps, sort of close to Italy and Switzerland. Mm. And ballet happened, you know, one of those cases, I think there's millions of us, like Billy Elliot type thing, where it just falls on you, you don't quite know where. I think there probably were some logical reasons why it just happened like that, but at the time, just feel it's this very strange thing happening. So I started like this, and my parents were supportive in the sense that I could do it, but the condition is that academic studies were going on at the same time. So I did full curriculum of regular school, like everyone would, up until 18 years old. So I left the little village to go to the nearest big city when I was 12 years old, because ballet was becoming a little bit more serious. Mm-hmm. And then at 14, I asked my parents to go to Paris, and living with my sister. Mm-hmm. And so it was all very exciting. And there, it was a little bit, you know, it was a massive chance because I wasn't really built at this time to be a dancer, especially not a ballet dancer. So,
Why do you say that? What do you mean?
I think physically I wasn't really at all equipped for it. It's, you know, I was Yeah, it had like terrible feet, and it was just like horrendous for ballet. And it was also, you know, the great, great years, of course, of Paris Opera, you know, in France. So, you know, what we thought was standard was pretty astonishing. I mean, we had Sylvie just joining the company, you know, and it was like, that was the minimum that you needed to have. And, yeah, so the standards were very, very, very high in Paris in the mid-80s at this point. And so I just kind of moved there to try it out in a way. And that's why the condition as well for my parents was very much, you need to keep your regular school going because you have no idea if you're ever going to get a job with this. And then training in Paris Opera, first I joined the Conservatoire in Paris, which at the time was pretty amazing. The teachers were great. You know, we had Serge Golovin and Christian Vossard and Attilio Labis and Clermont was there. So these were great, great names. Really, they were all teachers in Paris Opera, by the way, the school and the company. Okay. So the teaching was extraordinary. And there I worked personally a lot with a teacher called Gilbert Meyer. And Gilbert Meyer had a very, is a wonderful teacher, and he had a wonderful way to work where he could really mold your body, actually, if it was done well. And I was still young enough, I think, and my body did respond very well. And so really ended up kind of transforming very quickly. So from then I joined Paris Opera School, and I did about a year and a half there.
And how old were you then?
I was probably 17, I think.
17, wow. So, I'm drinking iced coffee at the moment. You might hear the tinkling of ice. I promise it's not a cocktail.
Desperate for that coffee. I'll get some whiskey here. So yeah, I was 17, but you know, again, in Paris Opera, which actually nowadays, when you say 17, students are still, you know, at school or joining like second companies and stuff. In our generation in France, 17 was already pretty old. And it really was. You really felt like, wow, you're just pushing your luck there. And so, yes, 18 even at the end. And it didn't go well at all for me in Paris Opera. It wasn't, I think I wasn't equipped mentally to be in that environment. And so
what was Paris the environment Opera, like?
The environment was very serious. It was like what I call, you know, professional students. And in Paris, they were together since they were quite young. In the school, they were joined maybe at 10 or 11, and they all knew each other. And there was a very serious way to go about it. And I had been very serious about it. But the Conservatoire, where I came from, people came from all around the country again. And it was much more, I don't know, it was, I think, friendlier, actually.
Yeah.
And but I think I was just a little bit too impressed, really, with Paris Opera. Yeah. I was very, 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 very nervous.
I feel like a lot of the common misconceptions about ballet were formed in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like all of that cattiness really is a derivative of the 80s and 90s, I think, because I haven't experienced that in the way it's depicted in books and film.
Yeah, I think it was also different places. And I'm sure, and you know, some people had fantastic time in Paris Opera. And I think that's why I very much stress that it's also what I came with and what I was equipped for and not equipped for. And also then, so after Paris Opera, I actually stopped dancing. I was just gutted and I didn't enjoy it. And it was really painful. So I completely stopped dancing. I went because I had this baccalaureate, those end of high school grades. I was able to go to university. And it was a fantastic time. It was great to leave ballet behind. It felt amazing. Like this freedom suddenly. And
what do you mean? What about it made you feel free?
I think I remember distinctively at the time thinking that your hard work was enough. As it felt like in ballet, your hard work was not enough in Paris Opera, for sure. It was, you were either, you know what I mean? You were either designated to get it and to have it, or you were not. And I felt that was, it was difficult because I started, you know, with such a massive hurdle, which was my body and coming from deep down in the provinces of the country. And, and you know, it was a long schlep to even get there. And just, so even just your hard work didn't seem quite enough.
Yeah.
And when I went to university, suddenly it was all you had to do is study very, very hard and you would just get the grades, and knowledge was very accessible. And again, ballet felt quite mysterious. You know, I think we're talking also of times before internet, where, you know, we didn't have much information of anything at all. After Paris Opera, you know, I should have gone straight to, you know, I was 6'2", I should have gone straight to New York or Amsterdam or companies with that very tall dancers. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know that this company were about that or were for people like me. So this made massive differences, you know, on how we behaved and how we felt about things.
Of course. And it's so fascinating to me that you found going to university to be simpler than trying to get into a ballet company.
God, way simpler. Way simpler.
That's fascinating and says a lot about the world of ballet and how complex and niche it really is and how much hard work it is. But that's not saying university isn't hard work. It's just different work. And I think perhaps when you have a certain level of intelligence, university can come quite easy to you if you have the discipline and perseverance already ingrained in you.
That's right. That's right. And again, you know, it was a time when, like my teacher in Paris Opera, I mean, it was quite dark. He would look around, scan around the room, and he would say, you know, it's very nice to like ballet, but it's better if ballet likes you.
Oof.
You would stop this. You know, so it was very much, we were really up against it. And it wasn't like a cuddly, you know, we're all in it together, team effort. It was very much, you know. So, yeah, so that was strange. And then, so I was happy with university. And then this wonderful thing happened, which is I had seen already a choreography by Bill Forsyth in Paris Opera. Mm-hmm. And then his company was in residence twice a year in the Châtelet in Paris. Mm-hmm. And while I was studying, I went to see the show one night with a mate, and, you know, it just hit me full blast. And I just thought, no, I need to dance. So then there was quite a few months of back and forth, and I did audition for Bill, and there was an opportunity there, and I did go to Frankfurt, but I was way too young. I was 19. Mm-hmm. And at a time when his company was, you know, full of wonderful, mature dancers who had done brilliant careers around the world and then gone to Frankfurt. So wasn't the right place at all for me, but that kind of got me back dancing. And then I did find a contract with one of the companies of the Royal Ballet called Birmingham Royal Ballet. Mm-hmm. At the time, they were very close together, Birmingham Royal Ballet and Royal Ballet. Mm-hmm. And so I joined BRB in 1990. And it was such a, and really in hindsight as well, such a gift. Because had I stayed in Paris Opera, I would have just stayed in that mold in a way. And going to England, where it suddenly was this completely different aspect of ballet, just completely blew my mind. You know, just the rep was wonderful. And, you know, I didn't know anything about Ashton at the time, and very few things about Macmillan. And, you know, we did some Balanchine quite a lot, and we created. David Bintley was very much creating on us. And tons of stuff, you know, like De Valois and Massine. You know, we recreated this huge Massine ballet. And so that was pretty full on, and I really enjoyed it. Then I moved to Stuttgart Ballet.
Mm-hmm. How old were you there?
This point, I was 24. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 24. And Stuttgart really was like, I mean, it was a complete dream come true. I think deep down, I realized it was always my dream company, really, when I would cut off, you know, little photos from dance magazines. It was always Stuttgart. And and I didn't quite even know, again, pre-internet, who they really were.
Yeah.
But then, so then I joined the company, and it was just extraordinary. It was, Marcia Heyday was still directing. And the company was full of characters, really. It was astonishing. And it was, the rep was extraordinary, from all the crankos to lots of work, new work. So there I discovered, you know, working with choreographers, which I didn't quite know at BRB. So I did Stuttgart, and that went great. And then sadly, I had a knee injury there. So came back from the knee injury quite well.
What was the injury?
Was cruciate ligament.
What is that?
The cruciate ligament, ACL.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah.
Cruciate, I've never heard that. Sounds like a Harry Potter thing.
Oh, cruciate ligament, because it's
cruciatus.
Like a... How do you say in American? Is that ACL?
ACL, yeah.
Yeah, anterior cruciate ligament.
Oh, wow. It's probably for the best that I don't know what that means. It means I'm doing all right.
Because you do just fine. You don't want to know that one. So that happened. And for that, I actually, part of my rehab was doing gyrotonic. Mm. And at the time, the only studio was in Florence, really, in Europe. So that was great. And I moved to Florence for 6 months. And there, you know, saw like a ton of art. And there was also a wonderful art biennale around fashion and art. And that, again, I think for later, really kind of made me aware of different things that I've not seen before. So that was great. Then I came back to Stuttgart. Reed Anderson was directing at the time. Mm-hmm. In between when I was off, Marcia left and Reed arrived. And I have no idea really what happened. I had a discussion with Reed before I left for my rehab, and apparently everything was fine and there was a contract for me. And I came back 7 months later, and before he even saw me dancing, there was no contract for me. So that was huge.
Was that legal? I thought you can't fire someone who's injured.
That was what I thought as well. And I guess I came back in, I was back in the company. That's when he gave me my letter. So I guess that technically I was back in the company, but you know, I was coming.
It was like right when you walk in after being injured.
Literally, quite literally. Yeah. I remember I had sent a fax at the time to say, I'm coming back to Stuttgart and I would like I'm coming to do the class.
From Florence, you sent that fax?
Yeah, from Florence and the fax.
I live for a fax. Like, that is an indicator of the time.
At the time, it's so vintage, isn't it?
It really is.
And I did that.
Machines, sorry.
Was that?
What confusing machines those were, truly.
My God, it was a trip.
Really? And I get those. Sorry, go on.
No. So I came back to Stuttgart and he didn't come to see class. Mm-hmm. And then so I went to the office to say hi. And that's when he gave me, it wasn't actually a letter to say that's over. He said just like a warning. Then of course the rest then came in throughout the next few months and it was planned that way. Wow. So that was, that was a big, big, big shock. Also because, you know, I was coming from a major injury. So of course I was dancing to go auditioning straight away. It's a different kettle of fish, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds absolutely hideous, honestly. I think that's bad behavior.
You know, I don't quite know what happened, and I think at the time it's like someone threw an ice bucket in my face. I couldn't even think for 6 months. I had no idea what was going on. In hindsight also, it's a tough one, but in a way, you know, it's better that I had to go. If you didn't have any plans for me, then I'm really grateful that actually freed me up to shake myself and just go out and try new stuff, and which is what I did, you know.
And what did you try?
So what did I try? Well, I tried therapy. And I'm joking, but that was really, really good. I had a brilliant therapist in Stuttgart.
Amazing.
Yeah, she was really kick-ass as well. I would see her 5 times a week, you know, German way. And
is that the German way to do therapy?
Yeah, it is. Huh. So it's completely covered by your health insurance.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. And and I thought I would just go leisurely there, maybe like once a week, you know, to have a little chat. And no, it was every morning, 5 times a week.
Wow.
But we did a lot of great work. And so I spent a year doing this. I did guest for a bit, for every now and then. But then I stopped dancing, pretty much like a switch went off. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of design came about, because I actually went for dinner one night with some people from the opera. Mm-hmm. And there's this amazing gentleman who was close to the opera called Eitan, and he would do those amazing dinners. And this time was a team who came to do Boris Godunov at the Stuttgart Opera House. And so off I went to have dinner and got really friendly with the amazing team directors and designers. And so there was that. And then so when I stopped dancing, by chance they were doing another opera not far away. And it's on the way there on the train to go and see them that I thought, you know what? Design could be a good thing for a second career. Mm-hmm. And really the only thing is that I was keen to reinvest what I kind of knew about theater from being there since I was 6 years old, really.
Yeah.
Because that's what I have in my pocket. That's all I had, you know, at the time I had other ideas, you know, to become like a publisher or maybe like a cultural attaché or, but I thought that's really jumping at the deep end, which I don't mind, but with theory, not much to kind of show for. So, and I think also the big draw, you know, was at this point, so I was like 28 and I realized I'd never lived in a city by choice. I always was in the city because that's where the job was. And at this point, London was the place to be in the world. And I really wanted to come back to England. And I felt really that's where my roots were in a way. And I wanted to be in London. And I thought, you know what, if it doesn't work, I'm going to do 1 year studying design. If it doesn't work, too bad.
Yeah. So where did you go to school?
So then I started to get very lucky. I got in, like really, because before, let's face it, ballet was not been lucky. It was pretty much, yeah. I mean, I got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
And I don't really, I would never change anything, but it was tough. But then I applied for this amazing school called the Motley Theatre Design Course. Tiny course, completely off the beaten track. No diploma at the end. Only 10 students and purely practical, no theory whatsoever. So from the first week you came in, there would a director, an actual working theater director would come in, he would read a play, so all the 10 students together, and then the director would come to you one-to-one as if you were designing a show for him to put on a stage somewhere. We had 6 weeks. And then you had a crit where you would present a model that you had made for the set, a maquette, and set of costume drawings as if you were presenting them to a producer or to the cast for the first day of rehearsals. Wow. So it was really, I mean, it was bullshit free, hardcore. And
do you still speak with any of your classmates? Oh, I'm getting an echo. That's not nice. Hold on. Okay, the echo is now gone. Do you still speak with any of your classmates?
Of my year, no, but of the year before, yeah. Two great friends of mine, and actually some from other years after me as well. So Motley is very much, it's a family, you know, it's only 10 students a year. It's
wild.
Really
10 students. Good Lord. That's a tight students. Group.
Tight group. And they used to, what was brilliant about Motley is that because there was no formal teaching during the year, they would really form the group so each student could bring something to the rest of the group. So, you know, like there was this amazing guy called Michael, who came from New York, from NYU, and he was an incredible draftsman and model maker and had all this technical knowledge. Mm-hmm. And then everybody would have something else to bring to the collective. So it was really special.
That sounds really intelligent on the school's part.
Yeah, it was. It was founded by this extraordinary woman called Margaret Harris. And by the time I did Motley, she was 94. And she had done everything. I mean, if you look at the bio, it's just like, I mean, Laurence Olivier, I mean, you name it, you know, she went to Hollywood. And
had you sort of gotten... Well, you went to university proper. So had you gotten through that whole I don't know, like wild youth in a way, and you were ready to sort of buckle down and get down to business for your second career?
No, there was none of that actually. And I think Motley, although it was super hardcore with work, was a little moment where I connected with other things, because all through the dancing time, there was no wild youth at all. Ballet was so hard for me, and I had to every summer, every holiday, every weekend. Also because I coupled the ballet training with the academic training, it meant that until I was 18 years old, I was literally working 7 days a week and super hard with the academic and the dancing. It was just insane. So arriving in London was the beginning of that. And then once I graduated from Motley and started to work as a designer, then I started to have a bit more fun, you know, so that was great. And these were brilliant years in London as well, you know, early end of 90s, early 2000. So it was brilliant to go clubbing and to go for drinks. And
where did you like to go at that time? Where were your local haunts?
Local haunts. Well, Soho was thriving, so I used to love that. But there was already some, pretty much, yeah, from the beginning, there was already some great places in the East End that I used to love. And the East End then became, you know, extremely trendy and changed a lot. But the
was beginning... Was it a gay neighborhood at any time, or?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Just Soho. I've heard of Soho as well.
Yeah.
Sort of a gay neighborhood.
Soho was, so the gay scene, I think, in Soho started really 91, 2, I think, first bar. So by the time I came back in 98, it was really full on and wonderful. And then it started to become a little more mainstream, I suppose, because then the everybody went there to party. So really the more trendy gay scene moved to two places. One was Vauxhall, and big clubs opened there. And then the East End became more experimental, a bit more grungy, and like Brooklyn. You know, Brooklyn.
That's, Brooklyn, yeah, drag, yeah, you know?
That's your equivalent, yeah. I mean, some extraordinary places, you know, there used to be... brilliant pub called Joiner's Arms that was just like an old skanky pub, you know, with the pool table that turned into the trendiest place on a Saturday night.
Fascinating.
The amazing crowd. So yeah, these were brilliant years and great atmosphere in London. It was
so
nice.
So what was your big design break then?
Yeah, the beginning was like just tiny, tiny fringe plays. Because Motley really teaches you, well, teaches you, tutors straight plays, like written plays and operas, because it's all about the text, honoring the text and honoring the performer. The whole ethos of my design school is just that. They tell you that really, actually, I think they said that the first day, we don't need design to do a great show, a good show. We just need a great material to be performed and a fantastic performer. So basically, yes, design will help. Design is fantastic, but never forget that you are here to support two things, the material and the performance. So, but I was, you know, just trained around the text. So I did a lot of plays to start with and little fringe stuff around London. And then actually the big chance really came strangely from dance. As it would, you know, of course it would.
It's paying you back for all the years of hideousness.
I think so. I think it's the karma points at Kishing, yeah. And it came in the person of Chris Wilden. And I think we literally bumped into each other at the Opera House like this. And we didn't know each other before. But there we talked and he said, you know, I'm just starting to choreograph. It was literally, he was leaving the company, I think, near Steve Ballet. And he said, well, do you want to show me your portfolio? Which I did, which was mostly student stuff. And he was really kind. And he said, oh, I'd love to work with you one day. And the chance came very, very quickly. A few months later, he called and he said, you know, I'm doing this piece for Boston, which in the end never happened. But we started to think about that. And then the first piece we did together was in Hamburg for Hamburg Ballet. And very soon after, we did a world premiere for the Royal Ballet called Trist. And I think this one really is the one where kind of, yeah, was like the real beginning professionally in a way.
That's amazing. So I want to skip ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you about Of Love and Rage, which is the Alexei Ratmansky full-length classical premiere that had happened in Orange County with American Ballet Theatre, but has now been essentially canceled because of COVID-19, and our whole season has been canceled.
Correct.
As we all know, many things have been canceled. Mm. But I just want to talk about the process there and just what your thoughts were and are. So, how did you get connected with Alexei, and how did you get the gig, pretty much?
I was not connected to Alexei. I think, I've realized through the years what I don't do well. Very aware of that. And the first thing on the list is networking. I'm just really bad at it. So it's, of course I'm aware of Alexei. I think he was aware of me. Like, we shared an evening together, the Royal Ballet, where I did a piece with Chris. Mm-hmm. And Alexei had a world premiere. So of course I was aware, but it's not someone I talked to or someone I knew. And I had talked to him years and years and years ago when he was director of the Bolshoi. And I had talked to him, and I think at the time he did mention something, but I was busy and I could not take it. Mm-hmm. But it's a long time ago. So by the time of Love and Rage, it's just like there was no contact there. And the email came in one day from ABT checking my availability. And then I came to New York. I was at the time in Santa Fe Opera doing a revival of Man and Butterfly. And after the show, I came back to New York and I had a meeting with Alexei. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And then I had the confirmation that there was this offer to do this show.
Did you have to present anything, or was it just based on your previous work?
Based on previous works there. And I think also that meeting, it's very hard to work with someone new. Mm-hmm. And actually, even if you show stuff, like the stuff in my portfolio, if I had one, would be stuff I did with people, as a partnership, as a response to their work, as a response to that particular subject, that music, or that budget, or that schedule. So really my work is so collaborative that you look at my portfolio and that's done with somebody, for somebody. So meeting somebody new is always difficult for me, because I think I want to start something different with them. I want to embark on something that I don't even know about that much. So that meeting with him was very interesting, I think, when we were just talking. And I think we talked about the story a little bit, but not much. And I think at this time it was more to like a general talk about who we are as people. Mm-hmm. And
it was a date. It was kind of like a date, yeah.
You're right. I always talk about saying that to people that work is very similar to my private life in a way. It's completely different, but it works with the same types of logic in a way, which is two people meeting. And what comes out of that? Well, you never quite know in advance. And if you did, you probably wouldn't want to go there.
So why do you think, after that first meeting, you mm-hmm. got the email that the production was yours?
Because they told me. I think they booked me at this point. Yeah.
No, I know, but after your meeting with... Had they already booked you before you met Alexei?
No. After, so we had the meeting, and then that's it. Then I kind of left, and it was just like, a meeting. And then I, maybe 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, I sent a lot of photos. That's what I did, actually. After the meeting, I sent a lot of photos of my work to Alexei. Mm. Because I wasn't sure what he had seen. And I thought maybe if he just saw the show we did at the Royal Ballet, mm-hmm. maybe he's just thinking that's going to be a look, I don't do looks at all. So I sent everything going in every direction as possible.
Yeah, versatility is key.
Yeah, to just open the discussion, really.
Okay, and then you got a hold of the story, I would imagine, and you started to develop what you wanted it to look like in your mind?
No. I never start with what things look like. Design is, theater design for me, is not at all what things look like, it's what they do. And what they do for the show, what they do for the artist, for the performer. So at this point, it was way too early to lock in into anything visual. And so I started, as you know, the story is epic and confusing and full on. And so I started to do a very intense work of mapping, which is something I learned at school. You know, like when you do a Shakespeare play, it's extremely complex.
Yeah.
And you can't design it until you know what's in there. It's normal. You need to survey the fridge before you cook. And so and so that's what I did. That took a long time. And then I did probably 6 months of intense research, both in like libraries, internet, but also a lot in museums, because it's an antique story. And I also made a point of meeting the chief curators of the Met Museum in New York, of some collections, and a wonderful person here in London at the British Museum. And I went to Paris to see the collection at the Louvre as well. And those discussions were extraordinary. And they really guided me all the way through. So it was great.
In what ways?
What ways? I met this extraordinary lady at the Metropolitan Museum called Kim Benzel. And she is a curator of the Near East collections. So that would have been Babylon in our story. And really when I met her particularly, what I wanted, it's kind of hard to find specific research about, let's say, what an interior would have been, you know. It's, you know, so long ago. The architecture is so fragmented. Anyway, and but when I met her, we had the discussion about that for her, as a curator today, showing antiquity in museums, it's about how do you show that, those fragments, and how do you present them to a contemporary audience? And suddenly, the penny dropped hugely, because I was like, it's exactly what we need to do with ballet, I think, particularly. And even more with that story, because that story is also considered the first historical novel ever written, for the reason that the playwright, the novelist, Chariton, is using some characters that have happened, that have existed before. And of course, he's using them in a different way. He didn't have the right research at the time. First century after Christ, Google, not very good. very patchy. But so what Kim was saying had a direct echo for me on how the novel is written, which was first century after Christ, but also I think what dance really has to do, and ballet in particular, which is to present something to an audience that is come from a bygone era, yet at the same time completely contemporary. And it's the same thing that they face in museums today. You know, when you have something in fragments, completely broken down, do you leave it in bits like that, but then it doesn't convey the story? Do you reconstruct it in a Disney World kind of a way, but then that's kind of belittling it? Or do you find a happy medium? And do you try to reconstruct maybe the shape of it, but you leave some gaps in the middle, or you leave the cracks on it? Or and for me, that was amazing, because this particular show was really, really, really tricky as a designer, because you already have tons of work that address that thing. So you have Sylvia by Ashton that does it very well. Mm-hmm. Then you have Spartacus, of course. I mean, there's tons of other ballets that treat this kind of subject that have been done. And as soon as I went into one direction, and that's why it's very dangerous to go too quickly into what should it look like. Because when I started to do that in my head, of course, I couldn't help it sometimes. Every time I went into a cul-de-sac, I'm like, well, no, that's Sylvia. No, yeah. That's Spartacus. No, that's John Lemaire, Sylvia in Paris Opera, or for his company, you know, very wonderful, beautiful design. Jürgen Kokos. So, Yanis Kokos. So this process of really talking to people re-geared me and completely helped me find my own way with this.
So once you started diving really deeply into the story, how did you feel it was going to relate to today's standards in society? Because I found this to be a point of contention among the dancers, among the marketing staff, among anybody who really knew the story. It's an archaic tale that does not necessarily hold up in today's society. Being a historic tale, that does not render it completely useless. It's just how we repurpose it. So how did you repurpose it in your mind to make it justifiable?
Well, you're going heavy, aren't you?
Well, I want to know.
No, you're absolutely right, and it's great. Because really, this discussion started straight away.
Yeah.
Of course, I opened the novel and I was like, wow, exactly how do you do that today? And I think that's why for me, the approach was very much to not design the thing, not making it look pretty or imagine. And so what I did is I brought all the broken artifacts that exist today in museums around the world about those particular places and locations and times when the story is about to take place. So that was my way to honor the time and the place, but also the fact that huge amount of violence has either happened to those things or was made to those things. Mm-hmm. And for me, there was an echo with that, with the story.
So for those who don't know, the story is fascinating, and you can read the novel. You can download it to your Kindle if you're so inclined. What's the technical name of the novel, the full name of it? Carius?
Carius and Caliroe.
Caliroe, yeah. So that has crazy spelling. So just Google Chariton, Chariton. That's the author.
Yeah.
And the story has a great deal of violence and oppression. Specifically against the female protagonist. And I can't even tell you how difficult I was in this process with Alexei. But that's another story for another time.
No, but I wanted to ask you about that actually, because, you know, watching the finished product, the end result on stage, I really loved that your character, for instance, and actually all characters I find, ended up on the page. And when we talk about the story, they are so two-dimensional. And really, and to be quite frank, you know, all along I had doubts about it, and we all did. But then I had the hope that on stage, the performers would make it three-dimensional. And that was my, I don't know how you felt about it, but it was really my feeling. I finally sat down and looked at the show and I thought, this is extraordinary, because like I watched you doing Dionysos and Blaine, you know, and I watched all the cast, and I saw people bringing so much humanity, modernity to those characters that in the end, and I think that's one of the great strengths of dance, but particularly of ballet really, is that and I really enjoyed this, it kind of gives to the audience a chance to make up their mind. And if the context is right, and that's why it's very fragile how you contextualize this story, this art form, those characters as a designer, because you can gear them to think one way or the other. So for me, the set came from a fragmented archaeology. So it looks antique, but actually it's done in a quite modern way. Mm. There's a lot of black around the stage. It's done very, in quite minimal kind of a way. And then the clothes, actually, although they are somehow a little bit period, actually quite contemporary as well. Mm-hmm. The stuff, you know, that we could completely wear today. And so it was my way to say, okay, I don't want to change the story. I can't change the story. It's not my job. It's a tricky story. Let's see what we do with it. We have an amazing choreographer dealing with this. amazing artists on stage, I just want to gear the audience towards accessing some themes and being able to make up their mind about it.
Absolutely. I think, first of all, I think you did an exquisite job with this ballet.
Thanks.
Unbelievable. I mean, from drawing to stage completely blew my mind. And I felt so comfortable in all of my costumes, which is rare and usually just never happens, quite frankly. But that aside, I feel there was such a fine line to walk. This ballet is not a comedy. It has lightness at times, but it's really, really heavy. And in order for it not to feel like a complete, you know, sort of sadness porn, the characters had themselves to be real people, which is really hard in story ballets. I mean, classical ballet acting itself is so freaking weird also. So you have to be transported for the audience to make the decision to believe us. And I think that was our biggest task. Not only the story itself was important and tough to tell, but we had to make it, we had to make the audience want to believe, which is a hard hurdle to jump.
Yeah.
But I'm devastated, honestly, that we can't share this work yet. I feel like from our premiere, it can only get better.
Absolutely. I think you're so right. And for me, and I've been thinking so much about that over the last few weeks and 2 months, thank God we premiered it at least in Costa Mesa, because now we know what it's about. And to be quite frank, I think all of us had to wait until the premiere to literally know what it was that we were doing even. And it was only possible because we have had those discussions, like you and I in the fitting.
Yeah.
And this discussion that we have now, we actually had it when we first presented the work. And those ongoing conversations, and I know it sounds cliche, but I think they are the key to not sorting it all out, not getting it all right, but getting on the way to doing this. So we at least had that chance to put it on stage and to know what we are seeing now, to work on it. And I watched 4 shows in Costa Mesa, and I was amazed of how the work being now yours, we're gone. It's taking its own life, you know, and it's always happening, but with this particular work, it was really, really quite touching and strong, because what I loved in how Alexei treated it as well is there is so much, and though it's casted, by the way, there is so much room, literally, for interpretation and for the artist and for the moment. And that is key for us to not be stuck in the past and to not be stuck in one reading of that difficult story as well. And that is, for me, it was very, very touching to watch it on stage, because it looks on the surface like an absolutely traditional ballet until you realize, I realized for me, it was almost like watching one of those great series, you know, like Game of Thrones, where you completely forget that it's like weird place, a weird time, a weird story, but it's so touching and so episodic and so epic and rolling forward. And it's, I mean, I don't really know a classical ballet in the repertoire that provides that. This kind of epic.
Yeah, it really is. I think the key is not necessarily respecting the source material or respecting societal needs of today. It's sort of respecting the reality of being alive, like making that the highest priority is reflecting that, you know, the horror and joy of just being alive. And I think the show really does that.
Yeah, and not shying away from asking those questions and somehow trying to find a way to tackle them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very easy, not very easy, but it's an easier thing to say, oh, we can't touch these kind of subjects anymore. And some such... Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you think it's the right decision to hide the violence as it's been done for this production?
To hide the violence. Good call. I thought it was very, very, very clever the way it's done, because it's hidden in the reality of the moment, but it is shown to you in the dream. I don't know if you've seen what he's done, what Alexei has done in the dream section, the vision. Mm-hmm. Very quickly, you do see what happens in a stylized way.
And
I thought that was absolutely... first, I was like, oh, I'm not sure. Maybe we should show it on stage and kind of make it sure that we tell people it's not really a violent. Maybe she just... Because the main character, basically her newlywed husband hits her. And we wanted to make sure that we knew that she was fainting because she was petrified with fear. But I thought in hindsight, it's even better to kind of imagine what happens behind that door, because we don't see it, it's off stage, because it gave me a chance as an audience to really wonder what I think of him and to really think, God, he's horrible. He's a horrible character for the whole of the end of Act Two. Until Act Two, when he has a chance to give his version of it, and you see that actually he didn't, and she collapsed because she was petrified with fear. And I really enjoyed that. I also enjoyed that it gives her a chance to really hate him as well. And when she meets you, Dionysos, because she hates him so much, that she can really fall in love with that man who suddenly is there and super sensual in this completely different way, very, very mature, you know. So I like those choices. And again, I think that if we had completely rewritten the story and taken the violence out of it, the rage, then we actually had nothing to tell. And then it became a kind of a slightly Disney version of a story. Mm. And then it would have become kitsch, I think. Mm. So I thought there were some amazing solutions in this, and that came not as good ideas. That's also what I've enjoyed particularly, personally, with this, is I don't think anybody came with the good idea of how to deal with this. Everything went to the table and everything went to a process. And like my discussions with you and with Corey and with Aaron and with everyone, and Catherine and everybody in the room talked about that. And I'm proud of that. I think proud of having been in a process like this for a ballet, classical ballet. Usually you would have that for, very cool play or a super wonderful contemporary choreographer. And we did that for ballet.
Yeah. Okay, Jean-Marc, I hate to do this, but we are running long and it's all been fascinating. And I find your whole trajectory really inspiring. There's so much determination in there to succeed and just thrive. And I love to see that you are achieving that. And I can't wait to see what else you do. And I really would like to work with you at some point on a ballet of my own.
Can't wait. But thanks for being such an amazing collaborator. That's what I would like to say, because that's where it starts, really, and where it finishes, So that's my thank you, really.
Thanks.
Very sincerely. Huge admiration.
And vice versa. Well, okay. Thank you for joining me on The Stage Right Side. You can follow Jean-Marc Buisson on all the socials. You have an Instagram. Will you just say your handle again?
It's all Jean-Marc Buisson.
Any dots or anything scary in there?
Instagram, no, just Jean-Marc Puissant in one word.
All right, great.
No hyphen.
No hyphen allowed. Get out, right. Hyphen.
Well, stay safe, James.
Thank you. And you too, and I hope we can be together soon.
I can't wait. Well, we're gonna do Love and Rage at the Met the year after.
Yep.
So we'll have that and hopefully more.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.